Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on the management of astigmatism during cataract surgery. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Tanner Ferguson and Taj Nasser discuss best practices for ensuring optimal astigmatism correction and toric IOL use. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson Surgical Vision, Inc. and Contimac U.S. First, Dr. Nasser focuses on the impact of corneal astigmatism and the minimum amount of astigmatism that should be treated, with Dr. Ferguson then adding his perspective.
Basically, what we're talking about is astigmatism correction, where we have an irregular surface of the cornea, so it's not perfectly spherical. And the way I like to explain it to patients is, so you know how your cornea is the very front structure of your eye? Instead of it being shaped like a baseball or round, it's actually shaped like the back of a spoon. So it's longer on one side compared to the other. And why is that important? Well, it impacts the degree of blur and how you see the world. So from a quality of vision standpoint, addressing astigmatism impacts overall functionality, which is important. And a common question sometimes that we get is, well, how low of astigmatism should I treat? You know, is a patient even going to notice half a diopter of cylinder? Well, this advanced optic study looked at basically looking at cross-cylinder astigmatism to patients, and they noticed that a subjective mean threshold, meaning how much of astigmatism can patients actually notice, and they can even notice about a quarter diopter of cylinder, which is important.
Yeah, the one other thing I'll add here is there was another good study, I think a few years ago, from Schallhorn, that looked at over, I think, 16,000 cataract surgeries. And they looked at the impact of uncorrected astigmatism on uncorrected visual acuity after surgery. And starting at least a half diopter was when you started to notice an impact on patient satisfaction. And I think the number, when it got to 0.75 diopters of residual astigmatism, was like six times more likely to be unhappy. And so that, I think, you know, with a huge study, lots of data, I really hold stock in data like that, that any type of, or it gives me desire to have a low threshold to treat any type of astigmatism at the time of surgery, whether that's with an AK or torics.
Drs. Nasser and Ferguson then discuss the various options for correcting astigmatism at the time of cataract surgery, including their perspectives on surgical incisions, flipping the axis, and toric IOLs.
As far as treatment options, many different ways, whether it's incisions on the steep axis, so planning where your initial incision is going to be to buffer the astigmatism as entering into the eye actually flattens that meridian at the steep axis, limbal and peripheral corneal astigmatism, whether it's using femto or manual, and then toric IOLs. And so this is something that we wanted to discuss here. As far as LRIs, AKs versus IOL, my preferred practice pattern is anyone with lower magnitudes of cylinder, then I usually opt to correct with peripheral corneal incisions. And when we're looking at, you know, with the rule or against the rule, depending on the calculation, and their candidate for toric, then I prefer to just keep the cornea untouched and plan for a toric IOL. I don't like flipping the axis from a visual quality. I haven't noticed personally, anecdotally, that from a visual quality and functionality that patients are satisfied more with the rule versus against the rule. So I don't flip them back and forth. I like, and the way I was trained was, if their brain is with the rule, keep them with the rule. If their brain is against the rule, then keep them against the rule. I haven't noticed that there's a better with, or would you?
I actually differ in that. I tend to target or chase the lowest amount of astigmatism, and I don't worry at all about flipping them at the time of surgery.
Correct.
Another thing that I've started to do is, I'm a big fan of the light adjustable lens, and if somebody comes in with, you know, three or more diopters of, or maybe two or more diopters of corneal sill, and I would like to use LAL, I've started to combine LAL with an AK at the time of surgery to make them more functional or to make it ensure that I'll get all their sill with adjustments. And so I've started to do LAL plus AK to kind of dampen or mitigate some of their sill prior to moving forward with adjustments.
Great points. So if we can address astigmatism as much as we can, it improves overall quality. And I think having that refractive mindset is important. Mm-hmm. I know we can just slap glasses or contacts on patients, but think about elderly patients who are walking down the stairs or are performing their daily activities. It does, and it's known to improve satisfaction from patient-reported outcomes.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think about is, you know, I wouldn't prescribe a pair of glasses without, you know, introducing cylinder into their lenses in their glasses. And so I think about that with, you know, if they have astigmatism, I should be offering them a lens that corrects their astigmatism with a lens inside the eye. And, you know, even with the, you know, broad landscape of IOLs that we have, whether it be trifocals, EDOFs, people who get a toric monofocal are still incredibly happy. I think, you know, many of these people, especially with a higher sill, they've been dealing with this astigmatism their whole life, and then for the first time ever, they're left with uncorrected, or their astigmatism fully corrected, and these people can be incredibly happy, and I think that's where the patient satisfaction comes in. When it comes to deciding whether to use a toric IOL on a patient with irregular astigmatism, I think the phrase irregular astigmatism can mean many different things, but I think if you're looking at the topography and their cornea looks a bit irregular, then I think you need to go back to the manifest refraction. And if a patient is, you know, has been happy historically in their glasses and they don't have an ectatic cornea, then I feel good about putting in a toric lens, assuming we have good measurements and that they'll do well with a toric IOL. And then which lens type is more prone to PCO formation, acrylic versus silicone, hydrophilic versus hydrophobic? So I think the studies have historically shown silicone is more prone to developing PCO than acrylic lenses. And then I think the same is true as with hydrophobic versus hydrophilic, and that's one of the advantages of a hydrophobic lens.
You know, as far as hydrophobic versus hydrophilic, I do have experience with both. I found the advantage of, you know, one versus the other, as far as the overall quality of vision, to be kind of okay. So we do have some silicone lenses where it's important, patients who've had retina history, patients who have specific pathologies to kind of avoid and usually prefer hydrophobic. And that's pretty much the majority of mm-hmm. my lenses is hydrophobic acrylic as far as and that's known to have less of a PCO rate compared to the hydrophilic.
Next, Drs. Nasser and Ferguson add some discussion on individualizing IOL selection.
You know, with occupations, with hobbies, with the way the more lifestyle-driven patients we get more and more, the more of an important topic this is. And so in our practice, we incorporate a lot of this in the form of a questionnaire. So one of the questions we ask our patients is, how, on a scale from 0 to 10, how much of a perfectionistic are you? It's just a really good kind of insightful question to ask your patients beforehand so they can kind of evaluate themselves, whether they're getting refractive or cataract surgery, regarding their level of neuroticism. Occupation is extremely important. So are you treating a pilot, whether, you know, candidacy for presbyopia trifocal correction? What are their hobbies? Is this a jiu-jitsu fighter? How much do they drive at night? What is the contrast going to look like? Cosmesis, sometimes simple things that we don't think about, such as like glint, how an IOL flickers for someone who's a news reporter. So there are certain things that you have to ask and elicit from a patient before even selecting the IOL. The preoperative refraction is extremely important. What are they at baseline? Are they low myope? Are they a plano presbyope? Are they low hyperope? How much of a hyperope? How much of a myope? Because it does make a difference. You're changing their overall and what their brain is used to. One thing that I always talk to my patients, if they're low myope, is, look, you have the world's best near vision. And I'm taking that from you. I'm flipping. Because I find that, and I don't know if anyone else has this same issue, but patients don't know what they'll miss after the surgery. So mm-hmm. they'll come in as a low myope and think that you're going to target their distance, but their near vision is going to maintain its clarity. And so going over what their preoperative refraction and what they're used to is extremely important. Now, astigmatism, whether it's with the rule versus against the rule, we talked about how we incorporate posterior astigmatism and how against the rule sometimes will give us more of a tendency to correct with a toric lens depending on the calculations. Regular versus irregular, Tanner's already touched a little bit on this. I look at the central 3 millimeters. I think that's very important. And how much of a magnitude is it? Because, like we mentioned, if they have a little bit of EBMD or if there's some dry, it will look irregular. So making sure you're treating that before signing them up. But essentially, a patient with super irregular corneas, which we'll talk about later, I really focus on the central 3 millimeters, just based on the optics and the central rays versus and periaxial. Now, comorbidities are important. I mean, one of our standard practice patterns, we get OCT max on everyone, just because anything that happens after the surgery is your fault. Mm-hmm. So if you miss a very mild ERM or a little bit of macular degeneration and you're putting a trifocal lens in, that that may not make the most happy patient afterwards. Pupil size is, you know, important for the light adjustable lens, just the aperture wise, and to be able to perform the treatments afterwards. Manufacturer recommendation is at least a 5.5 to 6 millimeter pupil, preferably larger. And then eye dominance. So if you're having someone who hunts or does a lot of hunting, which is their dominant eye, what are you going to target? So that's I would say, very important preoperatively to ascertain.
The other thing I'll add on, you know, irregular astigmatism is if you're questioning whether a patient's, you know, if their cornea looks a bit irregular on topography and you're questioning how much that's contributing, you can always do a Gasperm over-refraction before surgery. And if their BCVA is 20/40, but then they correct to 20/25 with a Gasperm over-refraction, then you know that at least two lines of visual acuity is being attributable to that, or two lines of blur is being attributable to that irregular cornea. And so that can kind of also clue in to understand how much the cornea is contributing to the blurred vision before surgery.
Awesome. We found really good success historically with implementing some sort of personality test. Not only has it been helpful for us from a culture building and understanding your teammates and colleagues at work, but also patients as well. So one thing we've incorporated is the DISC profile, and that's allowed us to have our inner language with our staff of, okay, is this patient more of a dominant, and how do you approach that patient versus influential? And so going through that activity has really helped us. We haven't administered this test to our patients. Maybe that's something we'll do in the future. But just having that inner dialogue within your staff has been really good for us from a culture standpoint. And then words matter. We know words matter. And I don't know, Tanner, if you wanted to touch base on why words matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the things that you have listed there are great. You know, things maybe to avoid saying and then, you know, maybe consider saying as alternatives. The other thing I'll say is when we're talking to patients, there's good data out there that as soon as they leave the office, you know, first off, we kind of overload them with tons of information. And then as soon as they leave the office, they forget, I think, up to 70% of what they heard. And I think it ranges like 40 to 70% of what they heard during the visit. And then if they do remember, they often misremember. And so if I think something's important during the exam or during the consultation, I will purposefully repeat it. Whether that be, you know, halos with a certain type of lens, you know, the cost, things like that. I'll make sure I repeat it to try and help, you know, make sure that it registers with the patient.
How do you elicit patients' comorbidities, goals, preferences of lifestyles? You know, the important stuff is to talk to the patients. Sometimes in a very busy practice, it's hard for us to find the time, so questionnaires help a lot. So having things done ahead of time for you just can streamline things a lot. So one of the first lines that we ask is, okay, this is a 68-year-old female who happens to be a nurse or happens to be a dentist, and having that just ready before you enter changes the whole conversation. And then two questions that I really like asking patients when they're trying to decide, you know, do I go distance or do I go near, or do I do a trifocal or an EDOF, is, if you break up your day into a number of hours, how many hours do you use your eyes for watching TV versus doing computer work versus reading? And it's important to actually actually say what they like doing. What are the number of hours? That's the first question. And then number two, what is most important to you? So do you read for 8 hours, but don't really like reading that much because you have to, but you love watching TV for those 2 hours a day? That's gonna change your discussion. So whenever a patient's on the fence, those are the two questions that I've found a lot of success with, is how many hours do you do a certain activity, and then what do you really enjoy the most?
Yeah, I think I also like to ask them, because, you know, many of these patients, you know, cataract age patients are late 60s, early 70s, is, you know, what do you do at home? Because, you know, these people spend a lot of time at home, but they often jump to, what am I doing when I'm out and about? But I remind them, you know, you probably spend a fair amount of time at home, and think about like how they use their eyes when they're in their day-to-day at home. And then also, I try and ask them, like, do you want to do a lot with glasses or without glasses? And that kind of helps dictate the conversation. And so another thing that we've started to incorporate into our practice, we have this at several of our locations, and is a VR headset. And this headset allows you to simulate different IOL options, including a monofocal. And so you can simulate correcting your astigmatism versus a non-toric. You can simulate an EDOF and a trifocal. And this has been super helpful for patients with astigmatism, so they can have a, you know, we can talk to them as much as we want about what astigmatism is, how it's going to impact their refraction after surgery. But if they can simulate it before surgery, you know, what happens if I don't correct my astigmatism? How's my quality of vision going to be at distance? It's been super helpful for those patients in particular. And this headset's great because it's interactive. And so you can, there's an indoor and a daytime and a nighttime environment. So there's one environment where they're like in a kitchen. They can pick up a cookbook and see where their near vision would be. And they can also dim the lights and see what halos would be like if they, you know, you're simulating like a multifocal lens. And I think it's helped us help the patients get a better understanding of what to expect after surgery. And then there's, I think, you know, specific patient types where it's super helpful, like somebody who's, you know, near myope. You can help them simulate what it's going to be like if you take away their near vision if you target them for distance. So it's been a really great use of technology in our practice to kind of help understand what patients' preferences are for after surgery. And so let's talk a little bit about, you know, what best practices do we apply to preoperative assessment of the patient and things like biometry. So I'll start here. So we get a corneal, basically three sources of Ks on patients. We get a NIDAC or an OPD on every patient. I think that's helpful for kind of qualitatively and quantitatively looking at the HOAs. So that's kind of, you know, determining the magnitude of irregular astigmatism. We also get a pentacam, and then we get a biometry in the form of a lens star. And I think having three sources of Ks is super helpful, particularly if you're kind of deciding if it's a lower, it's kind of on the brink of whether or not to use a toric. If it's, you know, the IOL master says, or the lens star says it's 0.7, and then the pentacam and the NIDAC says 1.1, I'll ask the team to repeat the lens star. Or that might push me to use a toric versus an LRI in a patient like that. And then the other thing on here is, you know, determining posterior corneal astigmatism. I know there's new formulas that incorporate direct measurements of posterior corneal astigmatism. I think the literature has been very mixed on whether that's helpful. And so I think the formulas that kind of make assumptions based on the posterior cornea rather than direct measurements are still what I prefer. So we still use the Barrett that is assumption-based or model-based versus the total K or Barrett TK. And that goes for both post-refractive and non-post-refractive patients. And I think, you know, there's even differing practice patterns within our own practice, but I like to get a pentacam on every patient because the way we kind of position a toric or a toric multifocal in our practice is that an enhancement is included with the cost of that lens. And so I like to get a pentacam because I like to know, is their cornea going to be suitable for a refractive an enhancement after surgery if necessary? And I think you also can glean some degree of irregularity with the posterior float and get a better understanding of their overall cornea. So I still like to get a topography in every patient. I also think it's nice. Sometimes we have patients who are not great historians. They don't remember if they had surgery. And if you get a pentacam and you notice they have, like, significant central flattening with peripheral regular cornea, you might be wondering, has this patient had PRK in the past? And that's happened before in my practice. So I just feel better about things doing a pentacam, but I know there's different schools of thought on that.
Dr. Ferguson begins a discussion on pre- and intraoperative factors that can have an effect on cataract surgery outcomes, such as choosing an IOL formula and marking techniques.
And then which formulas do we use for which patients? I think for non-post-refractive, I typically use the Barrett 2 Universal. If I'm questioning whether, you know, if it's borderline for a toric, say I see like 1.1 diopters of SIL and I'm wondering why I didn't calc a toric, sometimes I'll use a different calculator integrated into the biometer, like the Hiller-RBF. Primarily I use the Barrett portfolio, and that goes the same for post-refractive patients. We do use different things when it comes to keratoconic patients, and we'll touch on that here in a bit, but primarily use Barrett.
Yeah, same. Kane, I've had good success with the Kane formula as well. So we use Veracity for the smart calculator. So it allows us to then optimize our constants and feed in our information. And so Barrett Universal as well and Kane are my two formulas that I like using and comparing.
And then what best practices do we apply to identifying the seep axis and markings? Do we go digital or manual? And then maybe what are the comparative pros and cons of each? Placing incisions and then reducing the risk of postoperative rotation. I think, you know, when marking the cornea is super important. I think that's, you know, whether you're doing it manually or you're doing some type of digital overlay in the OR or using femto, I think that's, you know, when we're talking about reducing the risk of rotation, I think making sure that the toric is aligned where you want it to be is the best practice for reducing that risk. When it comes to placing incisions, if there's somebody who's maybe a borderline against the rule and they have, you know, an axis that's amenable to moving my incision, that's when I'll maybe shift my incision over, but I don't routinely do that. How about you?
I don't either. I follow the same kind of incision pattern, and then it's baked into sort of the optimization that I do with buffering as much of the astigmatism with either AKs or with a toric IOL.
I still do manual in one of our locations. You know, patients, the majority of patients do well, but when I'm doing manual, I'm always thinking to myself, like, there's got to be a better way to do this. I've started to use femto at one of our sites, and this incorporates iris registration and kind of creates these iris or these capsular, what I call nubs or marks along the rim, which has been super helpful for, I think, you know, increasing my confidence that I had this lens or marked appropriately or aligned in the correct meridian. And you can kind of see, I kind of tried to outline that capsular rim mark on the right there. And you can see how, you know, gratifying it is when those, you know, dots on the toric lens align directly with that capsular rim mark. And this occurs at the IOL plane, which does, you know, overcome some issues with parallax when you do the corneal markings. So essentially what happens is when you create this five, you know, whatever desired size capsulotomy, these nubs or marks are automatically created, which helps you kind of align the toric lens. And this has been fantastic. So this was a study published in AJO. They compared, you know, this iris registration capsulotomy with these capsular marks versus manual marking. And not surprisingly, I think we all, you know, kind of believe that some type of imaging assisted or iris registration incorporated is much better than manual. And for residual astigmatism lesser than or equal to 0.5, 88% of eyes with the iris registration worth less than 0.5 diopters versus 38% of those manual. And the UCDVA, unsurprisingly, was better in those patients. And I think taking the OVD out behind the lens in a toric, you want to promote some type of contact between the lens and the capsular bag to prevent, you know, reduce that risk of postoperative rotation. And if I'm, you know, I do that and I still see when I'm hydrating the wounds, the lens is kind of wanting to move a little bit, I have a very low threshold to put in a capsular tension ring at the time of surgery. I know there's not any, you know, fantastic data on that it prevents rotation, but I just feel better about it, particularly in somebody who's a higher myope. And then I think when it comes to improving the chances of optimal refraction and patient satisfaction, I think that kind of comes down to what you do preoperatively. So I think getting quality measurements, you know, treating the ocular surface if necessary, and then repeating measurements if necessary, is how you kind of optimize how they'll do after surgery. So do the legwork ahead of time to, you know, kind of help ensure some success after surgery.
Finally, Dr. Nasser and Dr. Ferguson provide their thoughts on managing special cases, including patients with Fuchs corneal dystrophy, patients who have undergone prior refractive surgery, or patients with keratoconus.
I'm faced with this situation every once in a while, and I think it really depends on how, you know, the severity of the Fuchs corneal dystrophy. If they have some mild Goutte or, you know, 1+ Goutte and it's not central in the visual axis and they have a pretty decent cell count, I'll still use a toric or an LA on that patient. I don't like to any type of EDOF or multifocal in somebody who has pre-existing Fuchs if they're not willing to do like a DMEC ahead of time. But I've done plenty of torics and LALs on this patient. They've done well. But there's also some extra counseling that goes in that, you know, you might need a corneal transplant at some point down the road. So let's talk a little bit about correction of astigmatism in the post-refractive patient. We've kind of already touched on this a little bit. So I've really liked the LAL for these patients. It also, you know, kind of overcomes the issues with IOL calculations and the risk of refractive surprise in this population. And then things we've already talked about, potential issues with alignment, rotation. You don't have to worry about that with the LAL. So it's been a great option for us in those patients, and I have a lot of confidence in this technology. So we published some of our work, and this was in eyes with a history of corneal laser refractive surgery, so PRK and LASIK. And in this study, you know, 61% of eyes ended up with less than a quarter of a diopter and 83% less than 0.5 diopters of post-op refractive seal, which were great results. 88% ended up 20/25 or better, and then 74% ended up 20/20 or better. Interestingly, from this study, we also stratified by if they had one or two or more prior refractive surgeries. And in those eyes that had, two or more prior refractive surgery, this would be patients who had, you know, like LASIK, then a LASIK fine tune, or then LASIK, then PRK. The people with only one prior refractive surgery did much better in terms of both refractive and visual outcomes. And then similarly, we published this in Eyes with a History of RK, and similarly had great results. So 64% were achieved less than a quarter diopter of post-op refractive seal, and then 88% less than a half diopter of post-op refractive seal. 88% overall were within a half diopter of target, which is fantastic for post-RK, and 82% end up 20/25 or better, 74% end up 20/20 or better. The one thing I will say, or a caveat with post-RK patients, is, you know, patient selection remains important. And that's where I think you really want to hone in on the degree of irregular astigmatism, because, you know, being post-RK, these patients all have some level of irregularity. And I think it's good to look closely at their HOAs and counsel them that, you know, even though we can get you to 20/20 after surgery, your image quality might be, you know, slightly degraded because of the presence of HOAs in your cornea. But in general, these patients, in my experience, I've done really well with this type of lens.
The LAL, there's a lot of excitement around, customization for patients and being able to, especially in a post-refractive setting. So for us, our go-to in a post-refractive patient is the LAL. Mm-hmm. And I would say I have a lot of post-refractive. So I took over a practice that has been 4 decades in the making and a bunch of LASIK surgeries after. So about 20 to 30% of my IOLs are LAL. How about you?
I'm probably a similar percentage, honestly. There, like you, there is a big crop of post-refractive patients that I see on a regular basis, and many of them are monovision LASIK. So I have, they come in, and if they were happy with their monovision LASIK, then I make a strong recommendation for LAL.
That's perfect. You know, with patients with keratoconus, things are very skewed, and there's different thoughts and preferences. Personally, I think giving patients a chance at correcting their astigmatism, even if they're keratoconic, is important. Now, if they're scleral lens wearers or RGPs, then I usually contact their referring provider regarding their level of comfort. So if there's a chance for me to buffer as much astigmatism as I can, and the referring provider is okay with fitting a scleral lens afterwards, patients get significant improvement in their quality of life by buffering some of the astigmatism. So this was a study that looked at 4 classical formulas, and some of the ones that gave the best outcomes were Brayer-Trouquet and Kane for keratoconus. And those are the volume formula I use is the Brayer-Trouquet for keratoconic patients. And depending on how high the Ks are, edging on the myopic shift a little bit more. So I'm targeting more of a myopia for these keratoconic patients compared to straight plano, just because of the irregularity. Correcting the astigmatism, again, it's a long discussion with the patient. They're irregular. Their brains are used to them seeing irregularly, but they're masking a lot of it with their scleral RGP. So if I can get them uncorrected to buffer as much of it as I can with a toric IOL, I'll give that a chance. As long as the patient and whoever's fitting them with contact lenses are okay with fitting them afterwards. Otherwise, then I would just keep it simple, monofocal, non-toric for these patients. As a key takeaway.
Yeah, I think, as you kind of mentioned, I think sometimes we're talking to these patients about, you know, you still might, we're going to try and make you more functional without the need for corrective lenses, particularly in these patients who have super high levels of SIL. And so our goal is going to be to get it to where you're not totally dependent on a pair of glasses, but you still might need a pair of glasses for your best possible vision. And I think that's a conversation you have ahead of time. And I kind of have the same, you know, similar practice patterns when it comes to formula and targeting before surgery. And you can kind of appreciate on here how you can select specifically for keratoconus, both on the Barrett True K and the cane. So there's a button you can select on each of those. And that's what they mean by keratoconus-specific formulae.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.